Welcome back and Happy New Year, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And we have two very special guests with us today, gentlemen. We have Trent Claus and Edson Williams, who are with Lola, a special effects company that did some really groundbreaking, not just special effects work, but I'd say character work in this movie. And we'll talk to them all about that and find out what they did and how they did it. Welcome, Trent and Edson.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here.
We're so happy to have you. Hal, tell us what happens.
Well, here comes minute 15. At the Army Recruiting Center in the bustling World Exhibition of Tomorrow, Bucky Barnes stands with Steve Rogers, his frustration evident. Right, because you got nothing to prove, he says, his voice laced with sarcasm. Two girls approach, one calling out, "Hey, Sarge, are we going dancing?" Bucky flashes a smile. "Yes, we are." He turns to Steve, realizing his friend won't budge from the recruiting office. "Don't do anything stupid until I get back," Bucky warns. "How can I?" Steve quips, a grin breaking through. "You're taking all the stupid with you." Bucky pulls Steve into a quick hug. "You're a punk." "Jerk," Steve shoots back. "Be careful." Bucky walks off with the girls, glancing back as Steve calls out, "Don't win the war till I get there." Bucky gives Steve a laconic salute as he leaves. Now there's my cat, too. For everybody, my cat can be a guest in this show. Angry old cat right now. Bucky gives Steve a laconic salute as he leaves. "Come on, girls," Bucky says, smirking. "They're playing our song." A man with glasses and a beard studies Steve from inside the recruitment center. The scene shifts to the examination room of the recruiting center, where Steve sits on an exam table, buttoning up his shirt, his slight frame dwarfed by the sterile space.
Wow, what a great
mini 15 with a guest appearance by my cat.
Wait, what's the cat's name, film. Just so we get it on the record?
The cat is Hobson.
Hobson.
As in the butler from Arthur.
Ah.
I'll alert the media.
I shall alert the media, yeah, exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Wow, well, here we are. Lola is doing amazing work even to this day, but this work in Captain America, which we're focused on right now, Joe Johnston, the director, said he would love to listen to this episode because he doesn't know how you guys pulled it off. He said there were so many different possibilities in getting this done, and it's not simply, you know, twisting the percentage knob and how thin you want to make Steve, but there was a lot of things going on. And yeah, I know the two of you must have spent many sleepless nights trying to figure all this out, given the raw material that Joe handed off to you. How did Lola first get involved in this part of the production?
I mean, I started out. Chris Townsend, which is a visual effects supervisor, reached out to us. We know a lot of the producers there. We did work with Kevin Feige and Chris before, and they came back. They came out to us with this. A test. So they cast a skinny lookalike. He's a Broadway actor. It was like he has a strong presence, but he's a small guy with a big presence. And that was our body double to match to. So they shot some test footage of a lookalike actor. It wasn't Chris Evans, but it was a lookalike actor. And they said they wanted to slim him down. And then we slimmed him down. And they're like, "Go further." We're like, "How much further?" And they're like, "Further." And eventually we landed on a test that they were really happy with. But to that point, it was the hardest work we've ever done. Because we had to isolate him from the background, clean plate what was behind him, and then shrink him down proportionally. It was incredibly challenging. And when once we started doing the principal photography, Chris Evans was adamant that it was his performance. So I say probably with the exception maybe two or three shots that we used the body double, the rest of the time was all Chris Evans. And because he wanted his performance to come through. He's an amazing actor, and he was very clear in his desire. It was his performance, not someone else's. And it made it even more challenging because we had to shrink down an amazing actor and maintain the shape.
So the layman's take on what you did might be something like you took Chris Evans and you photoshopped him to make him look skinny and shorter, but that's not it at all. You had another actor there on stage, on site, the skinny actor. What's his name? I'm sorry. We knew it at one point. Leander?
Leander. Leander.
Yeah, Leander. Yeah.
Yeah. As Jim alluded to, when we talked to Joe Johnston, he just said, I had no idea how they did it. On the day in the set, it sounded like he was befuddled, like, realizing in the moment that he needed to get some shots to make this work.
It was definitely a challenge. Yeah, it was, we shot for the build and the size of the double at first, and then after a good while of working on the show, there was a creative change where they had determined that they wanted him to look even more scrawny than the double. So then we were going even further than the actual human double. Which was a big ask. It was a little scary at the time, but it turned out, I think, a wise decision. It looks great what they had landed on.
But yeah, Leander was not a muscular man, so it was like they wanted to make it even smaller.
But it looks in the movie like he's about, 5 foot 5 or something. He looks like a tiny fellow. Was he actually that? I get that he was skinny, but was he actually small?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was a slight fellow. He was a
Yeah, he's slightly taller than what Skinny Steve is in the movie, but definitely a lot shorter than Chris Evans is in real life.
I was wondering, I do some work in animation and things, and the way I'm picturing this is that you had to probably build some kind of a mesh. I mean, I don't want you to do your trade secrets, but you had to probably build like a mesh around the body and then just start pulling the vertices in so that everybody shrunk without looking. But you had to do that every single frame and make sure that they hold up without getting all wobbly. Is that the right track for that?
Yeah, it's vaguely accurate, and the real trick is that you can't just you. I think you mentioned it earlier. You can't just do like a global scale. You can't just shrink him, because Chris is a big, muscular guy, and Skinny Steve is not supposed to be. So if you just shrink Chris Evans, then you get a little tiny, big, muscly guy. So that doesn't work at all. So you have to not only shrink him, but then also completely sculpt what the musculature looks like, the jawline, the thickness of the neck, how much the Adam's apple pokes out, even the way the clothing hangs on his body. And in many shots, had to be completely replaced, the shirts and stuff, because it was tight in some cases against Chris Evans' body, and it needed to be loose and with lots of give. And there's a shot in particular where he's doing the basic training where you can see the light through the sleeve of his shirt. But on set, it wasn't like that. It was tight against his body that all had to be animated by hand.
Wow. I
Yeah,
just
I
before we go on, I just want to make sure that we give credit to Leander Deeney is the actor's
yes.
name. And
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed I didn't look that up before we started, and all great credit to him and
If you watch
appreciation
the
for his work.
film all the way through, I'm not sure which minute it is, but he plays the bartender.
Yeah, he's going
And
to be coming up, and hopefully he has us in his inbox. So hopefully he will, Brian, you'll be able to apologize to him personally in a future episode. We'll see how that goes.
fantastic. So one thing that I am trying to sort of piece together in my head is, well, this is a two-part question. I guess the first part is, are you guys there on set, or are you working with an on-set VFX supervisor for these scenes, or are they just giving you footage? And then that second part of that is when you get footage, like how many different layers are there? I'm assuming we're shooting the scene with no actors in it, so you have the complete background, then we're layering from there. So there's my two parts. Were you there? And then what does that layering system look like?
yeah, Lola was on set for the first maybe third of photography for that. And past that, our input was less needed, so we're able to leave because they knew what we wanted. They shot clean plates. They were very, very good. Chris Townsend was the supervisor, and he's the one who really kind of, he helped us drive. He's very instrumental in developing the look because he was so, so meticulous in what he was looking for. So it really actually helped us a lot. It was almost like an in-house supervisor that was working for production. So he was incredibly helpful. But we were there for maybe the first third of principal photography. And then we went back once for some key scenes. But once they kind of understood what we needed, they shot clean plates. They shot the principal photography. They shot Leander. So we got three plates, a plate without any actors, a plate with Leander, and then a plate with Chris Evans. It was always, the order was always, they shot Chris Evans first. And then Leander watched the playback multiple times. He'd sit there and watch it. And then he had to recreate what Chris Evans did. He had to match the walk, because Chris, it was Chris's performance that Leander was matching. And then at the end, they'd do a clean plate. So that was the order of operations. Chris drove the performance. Leander matched that after watching the playback, and then a clean plate. And that was it. Once we kind of developed that routine, then we weren't needed on set as much.
Well, the results, as everybody knows, are just staggering. It's amazing to me. We're talking about this movie, already 14, 15 years later, and it looks every bit as good. And, we see this kind of thing evolve so much over the years, and we kind of say, what looks great now, we'll kind of smile and look charming in 50 years. But I honestly can't conceive ever looking at this and not just being purely convinced. The work was mind blowing. I guess the other big question then that I have is how long this whole process took, and was there individual was there a ton of time sort of spent on, once you've planned everything out, was there a ton of rendering time that's happening, or how did that all go together?
I think that first test was roughly 1 year before the movie came out.
Yeah,
and then we worked, up until roughly about a month before the movie came out. So altogether, it's 10 or 11 months or something like that. And the actual plate turnover when we got footage, was a rolling thing. So we didn't get our first batch of shots turned over probably until October or something like that, 2010, I would bet. And then it was hard work from then on.
It just strikes me as such a coordinated effort between your effects house, the director, the performers. What a collaborative thing, because things like on set when you're shooting, getting sight lines right, having mm-hmm. people look at a short Steve Rogers instead of a tall Chris Evans kind of thing. You got to get that right at the start, or maybe you can adjust that. I don't know.
That's a great note. They actually had an eye line to look down. So they control the eye line. It was clever. They control the eye line on set. They had a mark on Chris Evans' chest where everyone's supposed to look for his eye line. So when we shrank him down, they were really clever. Props to Marvel. I mean, they were so organized. But that was literally that's a great note. But there was a point you were supposed to look, and it wasn't in Chris Evans' eyes. It was down because he's huge.
So he's sitting there saying, "Hey, my eyes are down here." Yeah. Of the opposite of the exactly. old day.
Yeah. There's a sequence where Chris gets into a bit of a brawl in a back alley at one point, and then Bucky comes to save him. Edson, do you remember how they worked out the eye line on that shot? Do you remember?
Go ahead. Yes.
That's on the back lot at the studio, and they actually dug a trench down through the center of the alley.
Yeah.
So Chris would walk through the trench, a good foot and a half or something below everybody else. And it was just, hidden just below frame. It was really clever.
Yeah, it was comical but clever, right? It was like
we're going to have Kieran O'Connor in a upcoming episode. Kieran O'Connor will be joining us, and he's the fellow that was he's the fellow that Steve Rogers told he could do this all day too. He was the guy punching the garbage can lid, and he said he just had an amazing time with that day of shooting there. The thing that really amazed me of all the shots that you had worked on was the those outdoor scenes when you're saying you could see the sunlight through his shirt. Just trying to deal with differing outdoor conditions. I mean, you're not, you know, it's not green screen. I mean, some of it may be green, but it's, you know, outdoors with sunlight and you're, you know, bouncing lights off, and just trying to get the shots to match up with the background must have been incredibly, well, I guess it's among the pile of other difficult things, that must have been another thing you had to deal with.
Yeah, there was very little blue screen, green screen. It
Yeah,
was,
maybe like two or three shots. It was almost
yeah.
none.
It was mostly just dealing with the clean plates, and the clean plates are always helpful, but they're also never like a perfect solution because there's always slight changes between filming the main plate and then filming the clean plate, and so you can't just drop it in and it fits perfectly. It takes a lot of work to massage it into place and make it look like they fit together.
Yeah, there's no moco. It was zero moco. So it's like a poor man's moco, which means, yeah, it's about the same.
Yeah, I was also I was just wondering if a rough count, how many dots had to be on Chris's face if you were when you're shooting to get the lineups.
They had dots, but we didn't end up using them really. There's probably I think they probably did like 12 or 14 dots, but we didn't use the dots. We did face tracking instead of dot tracking. So it was actually almost more work to take them off, but it wasn't that many. It was like maybe a dozen dots.
Wow.
So go ahead, Jim.
I had a more basic question. Edson, could you talk a little bit about, I know that you had come out from being, you had been a digital artist for a long time. And by the way, great work in True Lies, one of my favorite movies. I used to work for the company that made Harriers, and just see, having my baby up there on the screen was just a very, it felt really good.
Actually, comp the where the Harriers are coming in and blowing up the bridge. That's many, many years ago. So,
Yeah, beautifully done.
thank you.
Yeah, you did my
And
girl proud.
I'm the guy who always complains when the airplane stuff is wrong in movies. So pat yourselves on the back extra
Thank you.
hard. But anyway, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, well, it's just how did Lola come into being as you were one of the founders here?
Lola, so we used to do a lot of music videos, and we're constantly doing, you know, digital work on the actors, you know, so you or the, you know, the singers. So you do a, you know, you do a music video, and you'd spend, you know, back then the video had a, you know, $1 million budgets, all the videos did, because they were, you know, MTV was alive and well. But they'd spend 50, 80 grand on digital cosmetics for the singers. And we're like, but no one's doing this for a feature film, which has a budget that's, you know, 50 times bigger. And no one was saying, how do we make our actors in the film look better? So we just kind of saw it as an opportunity, and we exploited it. We're the first, you know, first ones out of the gate to do it. So we, you know, kind of, you know, established a beachhead, and we're really good at it. So I came from traditional visual effects, you know, laser beams and dinosaurs, and you know, I applied my skill set to making actors, you know, look different on screen. And it literally came out of the music videos we were doing at the time. And we just rolled it over into a new company that specialized in feature films.
Yeah, I think the question we all want answered is, which singing artists did you do the work on?
Oh, I mean, I'll just say all the big ones back in
All
the day. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, it's
Good
like Fight
answer.
Club. The first rule of Fight Clubs, you don't talk about Fight Club.
Yeah.
I
Okay.
figured. I
Wow.
figured.
Well, I mean, the fact that you could make Hayley Atwell look old and Michael Douglas look young, that's Oscar worthy.
Yeah.
It's just astonishing doing all that work. How big is your crew at Lola? I would.
We ramp up and down. Our main office is Los Angeles. We're probably around 70 people right now. At our peak, we're around maybe 120, but you know, the industry is contracting, so I think we're probably around 70, you know, ballpark. But you know, we have office in London. You know, we have Austin, Nebraska, Los Angeles. We have a, you know, a bunch of artists working out of New Zealand remotely. So we do kind of spread the world, but the main office is Los Angeles.
Back when
Jim.
we did Captain America, we were much smaller. There was only about 15 or 20 of us back
Yeah.
then,
Yeah.
so we've grown quite a bit.
A lot of late nights.
Jim alluded to some of your other Marvel work. What have you done on the Marvel movies? I know you've done a lot of work on other movies, but how would we know your work from the superhero films?
So we started with the very first Iron Man, the first Marvel Studios film. And we did some relatively minor effects in that where, if you remember, there's a couple moments in the movie where they use this kind of paralyzing device. And the actor freezes up and you see some veins pop out on their face and their face goes pale. And that was us that made the veins pop out and the face go pale and that sort of thing. And then we also did some of Tony's chest piece as Gwyneth Paltrow is helping.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Chest and stuff. We did that as well. And a few other things in the film. And that really set our relationship with Marvel, and we got along well with them, and they appreciated the work that we did and liked us enough to ask us back. And then since then, we've worked on well over 30 projects for Marvel, just, you know, all the way through. The thing that people know us the most for is the aging and de-aging, I think, especially for Marvel. So young Michael Douglas in Ant-Man, young Kurt Russell in Guardians 2, old Peggy in Winter Soldier, and then old Captain America in Endgame. All of those sorts of things were spun off basically from the work that Edson started with the beauty work. You know, learning how to make people pretty, you kind of also learned how to make them look younger. And the first time we really got to exploit that to a great extent, Edson did amazing work in X-Men 3. There's a flashback scene with
Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Which was like the first time they did work that was essentially beauty work, but you could talk about it. You know, it wasn't a super secret thing. It was part of the story. And then expanding on that, we got to do Benjamin Button, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And that one really was a, you know, milestone for Lola, because it was the whole length of the film. You're making either all the characters look young in the beginning, except for Brad Pitt, who you make look old. And then at the end of the film, you make all the actors look old, except for Brad Pitt, who you make look, you know. So that was a ton of work that we got to showcase and really talk about. And I think that's really what started the whole aging and de-aging thing, because it opened up the idea maybe in directors' minds that like I could do a flashback and keep the same actor, you know, and that's really a big selling point for a director. You know, they want the audience to latch onto a character through the performance, and they want to keep that performance no matter what the scene is.
Yeah, and all at the same time, not drawing attention to this is a special effect. This is a visual right. effect that yeah. you're. Yeah, I mean, and that came through. That really shone through with Captain America. I mean, you know, it's like you got to forget. Yeah, that's he didn't really get big.
Oh, you know, hey, I'll make a note on that one. So there's a scene where he comes out of he's in a chamber. It opens up. He steps out. And he's just massive. And Haley Atwell goes up to him and touches him. She's like, "Ooh," she kind of giggles. Right. That was actually him. So it's so funny because people always assume we actually made him bigger on that scene, but we didn't. He was literally that strong and that big. So I just want to give up points to Chris Evans for, you know, all the push-ups he did. Because yes. that was literally him, and people assume we made him bigger, but we didn't. I just want to give him a shout out for the effort.
If I remember correctly, I think Roger Ebert's review of the film, he talked about how amazing it was that they made him look so big and muscular.
Yeah. He and Ricardo Montalban suffer the same problem, just looking too good.
Yes, that's true. Exactly.
Yeah, I guess Chris Evans has been your most altered guy since you did him in Endgame as well as in Captain America.
We worked on him for the first Captain, second Captain. We did work on the third, and then Infinity War and Endgame. So yeah, we worked on Chris quite a number of times.
That's a nice canvas to work with.
Yeah, yeah, and he's really he's really focused on the acting. I gotta give him a shout out because he wants his performance to come out, and he's polite to everyone, which I love. Not all actors are, he treats the cast and crew with ultimate respect, but he really does care about how his performance comes across. And I respect that. And he's of all the actors I worked with, he's one of the guys I respect the most because he really does care about the craft. So I do want to give him a shout out for that. It's pretty amazing.
Joe said that there was he thought one of the hardest ones is there's a scene where Erskine is sitting across from Steve in a barracks and they're passing a bottle back and forth and you had to like pick up half a hand and move that around. So
those interactions, trying to make sure that the hand could still interact with the other hand, even though you're changing the body's position in space, was really tough. And those shots in particular were really, really hard to clean plate because there's some very difficult camera moves going on where the filmed clean plate wasn't usable. So everything
the poor man's Moco is like no money Moco. They it wasn't even a poor man. It was like literally like a homeless man's Moco. It was so bad. They're like, ta-da, here you go. Thank you very much.
So in those cases, you've got to rebuild everything behind Chris by hand, and it's all hand animated.
Yeah, that's crazy. All those wooden boards.
And paint out the window too.
Oh gosh,
come a long way since Patty Duke was split screened talking to herself and things like that. That's amazing thinking about that handing back and forth and everything you guys had to do. It surprises me that you kind of assume that MoCo motion control cameras made such a big deal in Star Wars and going back to the late 70s. As a layperson, I would kind of assume, well, everybody's got them everywhere and we're all using them all the time and things in it, but clearly it's not the case.
Yeah, but the truth is that it's, for one thing, it's really expensive to use MoCo. And the biggest cause of that really is the time. It takes a tremendous amount of time on set to set that up and get it working properly. And it just really slows down production.
Yeah, and it's loud too, so you don't get dialogue.
Interesting.
I mean, they when they spin up and spin down, it gets really loud, and the audio guy is just shaking his head because it's unusable. It has to be ADR'd if you're gonna you're gonna use MoCo. Oh. And then it's not like a dolly track. This thing weighs they weigh a ton. It's like 2,000 pounds for these like MoCos. And it just takes so long to set up that you get two shots a day instead of the 8 or 10 you need. Sure. So we see less and less of it.
And I imagine there's a lot of trial and error with let's program this this motion, program this track. Wait, it's almost perfect except for here we've got to pan or tilt a little bit. So that's really interesting. Like I said, just as a layperson, I would have assumed it's 50 years on. We're probably have it on the iPhone 20 or something, that it's just got to be cheap and small and quiet and everywhere, but not always the case with technology, even though it seems like it should be.
I had a question, kind of 30,000 foot view. Who do you hire? What background do people who go into your line of work have? What colleges do they come out of or not college at all? How do you get a job like yours?
I mean, just use Trent's example. I mean, he came out of, he was an artist. He's a traditional artist, and he came in with a portfolio of little dot art. It was phenomenal. Some of the finest art I've ever seen. He had no experience in any feature film, but his artwork was just so amazing. Like a traditional artwork, his traditional artwork was like welcome aboard. And that was 18 years ago, right? I don't know how long it's been. Trent, how long have you been with us? How long
19 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's such a unique skill set that you have to teach someone it because it's we hire a lot of we're almost all flame based, so we use probably 80% 90% of our work is on flames, not nuke. We do have some nuke artists, but it's mostly flame. But you can be an amazing flame artist and not understand faces. So there's not a direct correlation with you can do a Super Bowl spot, but you may not be able to do a DH. So it's a separate skill set. So we really try to build from the ground up. And Trent's a great example. He'd never worked on a feature film, and all of a sudden, here, have a seat, and now you're working on a feature film.
Yeah, my colleagues, there's a big mix. There's folks that came from photography backgrounds. There's folks that came from more technical backgrounds, programming, computer science, that sort of thing. I would say most artists in the industry come from a film background. They went to either a film school or did a film program. I myself did fine art. I was a BFA in studio art, so drawing and painting and sculpture and that sort of thing. But there's also, there's folks that have worked with us and done amazing work that never went to college at all. And then we've also got artists that have like a master's degree and two bachelor's degrees, So there's big wide range of backgrounds, and it kind of takes it's such a weird huge collaborative effort to make a movie. It takes kind of lots of different viewpoints to make it work.
Well, as an artist myself, and I will defend cartooning as some form of art, it makes me happy. It does my heart good to hear that someone like you, Trent, with that background, still finds a place, because I think there's nothing. I think when a person lacks the fundamentals of understanding how to draw, how to use light, how to, how to create a space with a vanishing points and a horizon line, that kind of thing. I think it shows in the work. You see some effects work that you just can't understand what's going on. And I think it's because sometimes those folks lack the fundamentals that you have, that you learned as an analog artist.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest skills that is kind of underrated is critiquing. Being able to look at a piece and being able to not only judge and determine what maybe isn't working or what's unsuccessful about it at the moment, but then being able to verbally explain to someone what those things are and how to fix them. A lot of people can look at an image and maybe it looks weird to them, but they have no idea why. And they can't verbalize it in any way, and that's really not helpful, in a production scenario. So, being able to critique things in an effective way is really important, and that's definitely one of the things that I got drilled into me in college. Being able to critique my own work and then being able to critique other students' works and things like that.
I love that.
Yeah, I have to say, Trent, you've also made a lot of parents happy who are parents of fine arts majors going, how are they ever going to pay the rent? And so congratulations on turning it into a career.
I come from a relatively small town. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, and they don't make a lot of movies in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, they
So
do now.
that's true, yeah. So I was pretty far removed from it, and it did seem like an impossible goal to get an art degree and then get a job that pays a steady living, and I desperately didn't want to be the starving artist working in my garage, or even worse, my parents' garage, for the rest of my life. So I was when I graduated, I was really looking for something that there was a regular gig. I wanted and really VFX and movie making is one of the few things that an artist can do that is a regular steady paycheck, and you're doing art, but you're getting paid for it on a regular basis. And that was important to me.
Lovely.
You know what I love about, I'll tell you what I love about my job. It's like I do something and people see it. It's like building a house. Everyone who drives by the house, you say you're a carpenter, you build a house. Every time someone drives by the house, they see your work. And I really do love that part about my job is when I make something, someone sees it. And you can be a chef and like maybe two people at the table see what you made. But if you're working on movies, really, you could have millions of people look at your work, and maybe they don't know I did it, but they've seen it, and it just gives me a sense of satisfaction knowing that people see what I do, and it does mean quite a bit. So that's my personal love of this industry.
I love that too, because so much of art, writing, anything creative, any creative endeavor, just feels like spitting into the ocean. You put it out in the world and you put your heart into it, and you don't know if anybody ever sees or knows or cares. And you have, millions of people around the world appreciating what you've done. I think this is wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the ones that stay for the credits at the end that you gotta
Yeah.
say they're
Well, in
the,
LA, there's a lot more people stay with the credits
that's
in
true.
LA.
Well, LA always has the amazing thing when you're sitting in a theater and it's they're on page six of the scroll, and all of a sudden a bunch of people in the back start clapping. You're like, oh yeah, assistant sound editor, right? So, wow. Well, guys, thanks so much for doing what you do, for one thing. One of
Here,
the one of
here.
the one of the things that one of the reasons that we put together this podcast is just to be able to say thank you to for the people that help entertain us. And you know, like you said, it's and there's you know there's kids at sleepaway parties that are watching this on a DVD or streaming somewhere in a in the you know in the back of a car, and they're still enjoying the work that you did 14 years ago today. So you know, thanks for bringing that kind of happiness to so many people.
And the list of your list of credits is staggering. So if you're out there listening and you haven't looked up these gentlemen on IMDb or dug into Lola and their work, you've seen it a lot of places and a lot of really, really good stuff.
Thanks so much.
Great. Yeah, thanks for your time. It's truly an honor. Your podcast, this is a great podcast, and it's an honor to be on it. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
Likewise, we appreciate it very much. Also, we'd like to thank our audience. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.